Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. It's a lovely fall Sunday here in Brooklyn, and I'm speaking with one of my favorite bloggers, food writers, and I guess occasional supper club colleague sometimes. It's Kian Lam Co. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, thanks for writing this amazing book. I feel very lucky because it comes out Tuesday, so I'm getting the early scoop on the beautiful book called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking. Kian, this is amazing. I want to give you a standing ovation.
Thank you.
Really, really a truly amazing work. It's heavy. It's huge. There's over 150 recipes in it. I can tell you spent a lot of time working on it. I happen to know you have been as well.
That's right.
But it's amazing. And I just have to say that one of the first thoughts I had was that this is not your elementary cookbook, Chinese or otherwise. This is very much like a next level of in-depth understanding about culinary traditions and techniques and just amazingly precise recipes too. So well done.
Thank you. Yes, you know, the book is focused on techniques, and I really feel very strongly about learning techniques to be able to understand the cuisine itself. And you're also right that it's really not for a novice of Chinese cooking.
Yeah. I mean, it could be,
although it has a
and lot, actually yeah. That novice would be so much better educated if they could skip all the
that is actually
you know, the
true
saucy gloppy stuff.
That is actually true, because they can start from the very beginning, from the very basic. Yeah.
If only.
The book covers a lot of basic, for example, the knife techniques and you know, how to prepare specialty ingredients, and also there's a chapter on stock. And I feel very important about having the basis of the food itself in a stock. And a lot of people don't talk about that in Chinese cooking.
But you talk about it in French cooking so much.
That's right. That's right. So this is why I feel it's important to present this, because, you know, even in Chinese cooking, if you go to a professional Chinese kitchen, there's plenty of basics and the stock, the mise en place with how it was prepared properly, and this book starts with that. It starts with a lot of the preparations.
A lot of ingredients that you go over.
Right.
Sauces, dried stuff, all kinds. You do a really thorough job here. There's such great descriptions of things that I knew and I've seen, but I didn't actually know what it was. For example, the red wine yeast or red lees or whatever.
Yeah, wine lees, yeah.
That was a mystery to me for a long time, so thank you for explaining.
Well, you know, wine lees is actually a very common ingredients in my family because our family is from Fujian, and actually the red wine leaves, those are very common ingredients in Fujian cooking. So, you know, I thought it would be a wonderful thing to actually present some of the original flavors into the book, so at, you know, to let people open up their eyes to some of the other regional cooking rather than just the basic Cantonese and Sichuan and Hunan cooking.
You're so right. Thank you so much. And that's one ingredient I was like, I don't know if I'm going to include that because A, it's hard to find in my Taiwanese cookbook.
Right.
And B, nobody has written about it yet. So now that you have kind of broke that barrier, maybe I should go back.
Oh, no. I love your Food of Taiwan cookbook. That is a fabulous book.
Thank you so much. Just this book, though, let me just back up a little bit because you've been writing the blog, Red Cook, for a long time.
Correct.
Did you, 10 years or
no,
so?
No. I started the blog early spring of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
8 years.
8 years, yeah. So it's been about 8 years. And to be very honest with you, I've been spending most of my time the last 3 years just working on this
mm-hmm.
book. I did a lot of research going to China and visiting some cooking school and visited some chefs in restaurants and, you know, tried to learn the local flavors and also the techniques and so on.
Yeah.
So it was a long project.
Yes.
Like you say, actually,
was.
At some point, some of my friends thought of this as being my phantom book.
No, but did you think, though, all along while you're writing the blog that you would want to eventually compilate this cookbook?
Well, when I first moved to America, this is more than 20 years ago, I'm
mm-hmm.
like dating myself here.
But, from Singapore?
From Singapore. Yeah. I went to school in Boston. And during that time, you know, one of the things that I really miss is a good home Chinese cooking. And I wasn't able to find any cookbook that really explained the basic of Chinese cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are cookbooks that has recipes and such, and I really enjoy them. But, you know, I always wonder, why do we have to blanch or pre-cook the meat before we do a braise, for example? You know, it's always a mystery to me. And I for a while there, I thought, well, you know, I want to skip it. But what it does is it actually
it removes
a lot of
toxins,
the impurities when you parboil it. And so when you cook a braise, it came out beautifully clean. The sauce is beautiful.
No specks.
Right. So there is a reason why we have to do all that. And I was, you know, I wasn't able to find any book that really discussed that.
Mm.
And so this is when I started doing a lot of
research
and asking my family. And whenever I go back to Asia, I would buy some Chinese cookbook to try to find out about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of this background that I've already had for like the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started writing the blog, that's when I say, well, you know, perhaps I could put all this knowledge and put a book together. And that was sort of how it came about.
Yeah, make the kind of book that you wish you had as a college student.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of those questions. I can't even get that from my family members. So I'm like, thank you. I'm like, because you just do that. I don't know. no, but Red Cooking is your blog's name, and that's a technique in itself.
That's
so
right.
So you can tell that you're definitely focused on, explaining and drawing out and expanding upon these topics around technique and basic traditions. And what I love about this cookbook, it's not like this hit list of top dishes, you know, the most familiar, famous, whatever dishes from China. It's more about like, here, you know how to dry stir fry, and now you can make that with whatever you have.
Correct. And I think that's also what the purpose of the book is, to empower a cook to be able to take whatever they learn and then be innovative with it.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing techniques, you can then put in a lot of your own twist to it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to keep following the exact same recipe. In fact, the recipes in the book, really is there to illustrate the techniques rather than to, you know, give you multitude of options for cooking. But it's important to take to look at the recipe as a guideline, and this is how you actually apply the technique itself. And also every technique I describe how you can make a little variations.
Absolutely.
That's it. Yeah.
So with these techniques in mind, you can really know what you feel like making for dinner at any given time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like this mouth-watering rabbit Sichuan dish.
Right.
With that numbing hot mama.
Right.
You can make that with
that rabbit dish. Actually, it's called mouth-watering sauce, and it really is based on a chicken dish. But I have sort of switched it with the rabbit, and it really I think it goes really well with the rabbit itself. So
Yeah, that's a good ingredient. If you ever not sure what to do with rabbit, that's actually a tough ingredient to work with.
It is.
So how did you? I'm really curious how you decided on the dishes, because were these like a lot of things that you? I know that there's some famous dishes certainly throughout it, but for the most part, how did you settle on, say, mouth-watering rabbit or your stir fry on the cover, which is, oh wait, that's the chow
chow
fan. Wait, there was one other one that was just sort of like, oh, I don't know, asparagus and shrimp,
right.
You know,
the fried rice.
Yeah, like these aren't like kind of like, I don't know, what do you call it, like set in stone dishes.
Right.
Was it your own decisions?
Yes, that is my own decision. I think the reason that I wanted to do that is to also not only to present the technique, I also wanted to show people that, you know, they can be very innovative with it. Mm-hmm. So fried rice, it doesn't have to be just sausage fried rice with, you know, celery and carrots and peas and
right.
Eggs.
There's
I mean, you know, you can do that and it's delicious. But you know, with the technique that you know what to do with, you can put in all kinds of ingredients to it.
Yeah.
And that shrimp and asparagus fried rice is just an example of how to do.
Absolutely, and I think it shows that we're moving away from this like, oh, what's that called? Kind of culture around Chinese food, which I've heard a lot. And I'm like, well, it's bell peppers and it's some chicken. No, really, this is quite a.
And you know, the Chinese cook very seasonally too. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be great for people to learn how to, you know, stir fry, for example, and then say go to a green market and find ingredients there and say, oh, good, I'm going to pick up some green peppers or some fiddlehead's fern even in the spring, and then stir fry it with, say, you know, a wonderful
garlic chive.
Whatever. So there are all kinds of stuff that you can as long as you know that picking some certain ingredients would work well with the other,
right?
And also then the technique itself on how to create the stir fry.
Do you think or what do you think is like the biggest misperception when it comes to Chinese cooking? Because this is something that intimidates a lot of people. I know you've spent a lot of time teaching, so maybe you've heard a lot of perspectives.
Right. I think one of the biggest misconceptions of Chinese cooking is that stir fry is the only
thing. The only thing is stir fry.
It's stir fry. Because everywhere you go, people say, I want to learn Chinese cooking. They want to learn how to stir fry. But, you know, stir fry is only one of the techniques. And there are so many other, the braising techniques,
the steaming,
the deep frying. There are all kinds of deep frying techniques. And all these, I think, most Americans are not familiar with. So this book really basically wanted to introduce all that. And also cold dishes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most Americans, when they go to a Chinese restaurant, rarely would order a cold dish.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you know, they're not familiar with it. But but there's a huge repertoire of Chinese cold dishes.
I love them.
So.
Yeah. So what was I going to say? Oh, yes. I love how you explained the term stir frying. That was actually coined by a cookbook in the 40s.
Yes.
And that, like, so, and it's actually they're taking three or four different styles into one. Is that right? Or what's the story behind stir frying and how you came
to
know that?
Okay, you know, the basic technique for a stir fry really is a simple set of process of cooking, which is, you know, you start with the protein ingredients, and then you add on all the supplementary ingredients and so on.
Hot fire.
In a very hot fire, and it's very hot fire. And but most Americans just think of it as that's it, you know. But, but there are a lot. There's a lot of differences between different way of stir frying. For example, there's what I call a moist stir fry and a dry stir fry. Between those two alone, you know, there's a difference between what the result is.
Yeah.
With a moist stir fry, you end up with sauces in the dish itself, whereas with a dry stir fry, the you know, the flavoring ingredients basically just coat the food and not create
and
a pool of sauce.
And you have that kind of like sear that we get.
That's right.
That's right. I guess we would know as searing. So right. Stir searing maybe is
right.
a better
there
term.
There is
for
a wok hei is the Cantonese term for that searing,
that charring
sort of charring. Flavor, and Grace Young coined the terms, breath of the wok, and that's been like very popularized now. Everybody talk about breath of the wok, and
that's
really
scent
right
that you
referred
get.
To the wok hei. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so much to talk about. We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and be right back.
You. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, and we're on Eat Your Words. My guest today is Kian Lam Ko, and his new book coming out Tuesday is Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. Let's talk a little bit about that title, because you have we were just talking about wok hei and some of the descriptive metaphors throughout Chinese culinary traditions.
Right.
Breath of the wok, for instance. What is... Well, I know what Phoenix Claws is. One of my favorite foods.
Right. Well, you know, when I first thought...
it's chicken feet,
the
by the way.
Concept of the book, it is chicken feet. when I first started looking at the vision of the book, one of the things that I wanted to do is to demystify the Chinese cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Chinese dishes' name are always so poetic, very, you know, has all these weird terms and so on. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to explain to people what all
is
these...
What is the Phoenix Claws?
Right,
not
exactly.
Not this mythical thing.
Right, and so I thought, you know, this is great to explain. Chicken feet is actually called Phoenix Claws when it's presented in the Chinese menu. Jade trees really is a representation
broccoli?
Of Chinese broccoli.
Okay.
Right.
Gailan,
right. So,
and there's so many dishes that have crazy names. And sometimes we forget what they mean, but
exactly.
Or why they're called that. But
right.
I'm remembering, you have a lot of examples here, but Like ants climbing a log or something like
that.
Yeah,
right.
Which means like the little bits and pieces of ground pork on noodles.
Right. And actually there's a dish called stir-fried fly
Fly's head. I saw that too.
Right. So that's a very Taiwanese dish, actually.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Purportedly supposed to be a Sichuan dish, but yes. It has become very popular in Taiwan.
Absolutely. It's similar to like a sort of ground pork meat sauce that doesn't... Yeah, fly's head and ants climbing a log might not sound like the most pretty descriptors, but there's plenty more.
well, there's beggar's chicken.
Beggar's
which
chicken?
Which I love. It's a chicken that's wrapped in lotus leaves and then covered with... clay, and then it's roasted in the clay. So when you crack open the clay,
you've
got an incredible aroma coming out from the chicken. So there's a lot of different things. I think the reason that Chinese cooking is
so metaphorical, why?
Right, it's because Chinese food is closely related to a lot of the scholars in ancient Chinese, historically.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these poets, a lot of the scholars, Chinese scholars, they all are gourmet themselves, and they usually are the ones that describe in literature. They describe it in their poetry. They describe it in their written reports all about the dishes that they eat, and that's how they come up with very flowery, very poetic
goodness.
Names.
That makes so much sense. So, I mean, for a culture that has a cuisine going back to for I don't know how long, thousands
of years.
The people who are recording it are like sort of the upper echelons thinkers of their day.
That's right. Well, and the truth is, most of the very sophisticated, complicated dishes started in the Chinese court,
mm-hmm.
And so these are all very upper echelon people that enjoy
the
good food. And it was not until the Song Dynasty, which is about 1200 years ago maybe,
mm-hmm.
That's when more restaurants and tea houses beginning to open up for the populace, and that's because it was a period of very wealthy economically in China, mm-hmm. and it was a period of peaceful existence, mm. and so there are a lot of restaurants and
food was flourishing.
Yes, absolutely.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I love how you have this like really extensive history, and there's a timeline of Chinese history in your book. You have detailed sort of excerpts on each of the major cuisines, like Fujian cuisine. That's where you're from,
that's
right?
That's where I'm from.
Correct. And Hunan and Sichuan, and we're and each one is sort of each recipe has a cuisine usually attributed to it.
Right.
Although there is probably some more generalized,
right?
There are
those that are more generalized that I label it as being home style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think that it's helpful to kind of understand the history of and regionality when making a dish?
Mm-hmm.
It just adds more than just I guess story to your meal, but it helps you understand how to cook it better.
Definitely, because there are certain flavor profile,
mm-hmm.
that's very closely identified with the region, and I think it's important for you to understand how that flavor profile came about.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Sichuan cooking, the mala, which is numbing and spicy hot taste, it came about because the chili was introduced into the Chinese.
From the Americas.
From the Americas,
yeah.
Right. So it's not really native.
Mm-hmm.
But when chili was introduced into China, the Sichuan area, there people they're familiar with spicy food because they've always had this Sichuan peppercorn with them. And so they combine the two and it becomes mala. It becomes the numbing and the spicy.
Fascinating.
Hot. Yeah, and I think it's great to understand where it came from and so you can produce dishes that really has its roots.
And you wouldn't find this elsewhere in China. I mean, you might find it at like a specialty, like, hey, we're a Sichuan restaurant kind of place, but they're so distinct, each region.
Correct. Yeah.
And was that intimidating, though, to make a cookbook that has All of it?
Well, you know, when I first wrote the book, thinking of the book, it wasn't really intended as a particular regional cooking because I wanted to discuss the technique itself.
Techniques, absolutely.
Because, you know, many of the techniques are general and you can apply to many of the different regional cooking. Although there are a few that's very specific to a region, but in general, you know, most of the techniques are common.
Universal, yeah.
Right, right. So to me, it wasn't as intimidating in that sense that I was just talking.
Yeah.
So the regional aspect of it came about because I feel that we need to explain to people the background of all these flavors, and that's how it came about.
And just kind of like going back, what are sort of like the major regions that you would say in Chinese cooking?
Well, okay, there's, you know, you may have heard this 8 major regional cooking Chinese, and that really it was put together during the late 18th century and early 19th century when people
were trying to write cookbooks and
that
so
was
forth.
When they're beginning to like really record cooking and so on, and so they came up with these 8 regions, but the 8 regions only include the Han cooking. It doesn't include a lot of the minority.
The Hakka, the
Mongolian.
Right.
There are all these minorities cookings that they're just not, included in these 8 classifications. So if you wanted to look at it from the modern standpoint, you know, then there's a whole lot more style of cooking than just the
there
8.
Really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that has like kind of stuck with a lot of people, this sense of regionality, which is very true because it's such a vast country. But it's, there's a lot of back and forth and groups within each region and so forth that we're not quite privy to yet, but I love how you combine all this history in your book, and I can't imagine how you managed to, and then the food therapy you have, talking about how food is thought of in a very traditional Chinese medicine sense as, you
correct.
Know, helping to
correct
all your energies and everything.
Right,
so.
Right. I mean, you know, the Chinese always thought of food as part of the daily therapy.
Yeah.
We eat seasonally for a very specific reason. For example, in the winter, you'd want yang food, which supposedly keep you warm in the winter, and in the summer you want to eat yin food because it cools you down.
And
so
it's a cucumber.
And also then you know, if you are let's say if you have a little bit of a coughing fit, for example, you know, we would then try to eat a couple the different pear soups with chuanbei, which is a type of herb that help clear your lungs. So these are all, there are all these little things that, to be honest, even I am not familiar with.
But so ingrained
it is, correct, that's exactly it.
I love how you just really demystify that really beautifully. And it's not just a chicken soup for us, a one dish solution for everything.
Right.
Oh, here's another good one. Red cooked lion's head. These are the meatballs.
Right.
They're very common these days.
Huge meatballs.
And they're very home style. And this is a dish that I think that a lot of people who are not Chinese or haven't been there themselves wouldn't think to order. But it's such a familiar dish. It's like these giant pork meatballs,
it's very
essentially.
Comforting.
It's like, it's so universal.
Yeah.
And it's easy to make at home. It's kind of like a dumpling without the skin.
That's
right.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is. And it's and one other thing about this particular type of meatball is that it has a lot of moisture in it. So it's because you when you make them, you actually add a little bit of the pureed liquid from scallion and ginger, and it really makes it very moist. So when you bite into it, it's so soft and tender, and it's just lots of flavor. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful home style sort of food.
Yeah. It is. I guess we're almost out of time here, but do you have an absolute favorite dish you think everyone should make right away?
Well, I'm bias towards the red cooked pork.
Yeah. I mean,
that is like what my absolute
that's
favorite
true.
Dish. In,
that's your signature.
That's my signature. But still, it is one of the dishes that I loved. Because we grow up eating that dish at home almost once a week. Every week there would always be a red cooked pork. And, you know, it's just so
you
familiar.
You grew up eating red cooked pork belly once a week?
Yes, yes.
You're looking very fit, I gotta say.
Thank you. But so anyway, that would be my favorite dish.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to see how many people enjoy this book. I'm sure I'll be hearing about it so much in the next time to come. So thanks so much for joining us, Kian.
Thank you for having me here.
All right. And we'll see you next week. Oops. On Eat Your Words, today's engineer is Liz Smith. Today's break music was provided by The Landing. The theme song to my show is by the California Honey Drops. Our sponsor today is the International Culinary Center. And also, thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you like what you hear, tune into the show on iTunes or feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. Next up, a short clip from Evolutionaries, found right here on Heritage Radio Network.
I think talking about the ingredients is I don't know if disingenuous is the right thing, but I find it a little tiresome to say, well, we go and get the best ingredients. No shit, we get the best ingredients too.
Chef Wiley Dufresne shares his thoughts on ingredients and cooking.
Now, if you want to talk about the farmers, you want to talk about the people who are putting their hands in the ground, because that's a really hard job. That job's not fun at all. And I think that we can talk about them forever, and I think we should talk about them. The people that help harvest our ingredients are important, but to talk about, well, we got this really good me too. You know, it's your job as a chef to start with the best ingredients. What you choose to do with them is, I think, totally up to you. And one is not right and one is not wrong. I do think it's wrong to start with, well, let's talk about these ingredients. Like, we don't talk about the beautiful fish that we have flown in from Japan twice a week for you, because we believe that you should expect us to source good ingredients. And that's my feeling, is that any chef worth his or her weight wants to start with good product for any number of reasons. You want to have good product. You want to have good equipment to work with that product. Is somebody out there going, I have the crappiest ingredients and rusty pans and we make awesome food. Come on down. I mean, nobody's saying that. That's crazy. No, we start with good ingredients and we have an approach on how we want to handle them and what we want to do with them, as does every other chef. And I think let's talk about what you're doing. Not talk about where you shopped, because that's not as compelling a story.
For more of Wiley's stories and thoughts, listen to Evolutionaries, available on iTunes and heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.